Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, July 6, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, we'll be discussing the U.S. Supreme Court's term and its criminal law cases. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome John G. Malcolm. He's the director and Ed Gilbertson and Sherry Lindberg Gilbertson Senior Legal Fellow at the Edwin Meese III Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation right here in Washington, D.C. He's also chairman of the Federalist Society's Criminal Law Practice Group Executive Committee. He'll be joined by Dean Mazzoni. He is the chief of the Enterprise and Major Crimes Division of the Massachusetts Attorney General's Office. We're very pleased to have both of them with us today. They've got a lot of territory to cover, so I'm going to be very brief, as always, with my introductions. We're going to hear first from John Malcolm and then Dean Mazzoni. They're going to flip back and forth covering one or two cases in each interval. But as always, we'll be looking to you for questions, so please do be ready with your questions on any of the cases that we discuss today. With that, John Malcolm, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, Dean Reuter, and I'm delighted to be joined by Dean Mazzoni. We're going to be covering in a quick fashion a number of the criminal law cases that have not been discussed on separate telefora presentations that have been done over the course of the year. Let me say at the very outset that in general, it was a pretty good year at the court for criminal defendants. While they lost some important cases like Hyen versus North Carolina and Glossop v. Gross, Ayala, which Dean is going to discuss, and the Clark case, which I will discuss, they achieved some rather significant victories in, among other cases, the Alanis case, the Yates case, the Rodriguez case, which involved traffic stops, Mullooly versus Lynch, which dealt with deportation for state law drug convictions, the Johnson case, which Dean is going to discuss, and the McFadden and Patel cases, which I will also discuss. And even in Glossop versus Gross, that was the death penalty case decided on the last day of the term, it's now obvious that there are two and quite possibly four justices who may be prepared to rule that the death penalty is unconstitutional in all of its applications, something previously thought unfathomable. Well, let's begin our lightning round. Let me discuss a case that had an extremely emotional dissent, but I'm not sure what the long-lasting impact of the case will be, and that was Brumfield versus Kane. The case involved Kevin Brumfield, who was convicted and sentenced to death for murdering Betty Smothers, an off-duty police officer and single mother of six. Ms. Smothers was moonlighting as a security guard and was accompanying the manager of a grocery store to make a bank deposit when she was shot and killed by Brumfield. Under the court's 2002 decision in Atkins versus Virginia, individuals convicted of murder who are found to be intellectually disabled cannot be given the death penalty. And the question presented was whether Brumfield had presented enough evidence of intellectual disability to warrant an evidentiary hearing. Justice Sotomayor delivered the opinion for the court, joined by Justice Kennedy and Justices Ginsburg, Pryor, and Kagan, and held that the state court's denial of habeas relief was based upon an unreasonable factual findings. Specifically, the court held that an IQ of 75 is consistent with an intellectual disability because of the error rate in such tests, and that certain medical evidence of Brumfield that he had presented was enough to raise a reasonable doubt as to his intellectual disability, and that he was thus entitled to a full-blown evidentiary hearing on the issue. The court stressed that it was not characterizing the state court's factual determinations as unreasonable merely because we would have reached a different conclusion in the first instance, something Justice Thomas doubted, and stressed that it was also not deciding the actual outcome, but rather was going to leave the outcome to the lower court to decide on remand. What is perhaps most memorable about this case is the very passionate dissent by Justice Thomas that was joined in large part by Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Alito and Scalia. Justice Thomas gave an emotionally charged recital of the facts and said that the record below was more than sufficient for a lower court to conclude that Brumfield had not presented enough evidence to warrant additional discovery and a full-blown evidentiary hearing. Justice Thomas spent a good deal of time contrasting Kevin Brumfield with Warwick Dunn, the eldest son of the murder victim and a former outstanding collegiate and professional football player who went to great efforts to keep his family together and to help his younger siblings after his mother's death. Thomas went so far as to provide a link to Brumfield's videotaped confession and to append a photo of Corporal Smothers in her uniform at the end of his dissent. With that, Dean, let me turn it to you for the next case.
Sure. Dean Mazzoni, just to kind of reiterate what Dean Reuter said, which is that any opinions I relate are official attorney general opinions. I'm an assistant attorney general. They're only my opinions and my take on things. I would like to start with a very interesting case that ended up being dismissed as improvidently granted, as the Supreme Court sometimes does, which is the County of San Francisco versus Sheehan, which was interesting when cert was granted on a particularly interesting issue, that is, whether police officers making an arrest in a fast-moving situation are required to determine whether their actions would comply with Title II of the American Disabilities Act before protecting themselves and others. The fact pattern is interesting and sad. In San Francisco, the woman who sued the police, Teresa Sheehan, was living in a group home for people dealing with mental illnesses in August of 2008. And one of the social workers who was conducting a welfare check with Ms. Sheehan became concerned because she had stopped taking her medication and no longer spoke with anyone and was not changing her clothes or eating. When the social worker knocked on Sheehan's door, there was no response. She used the key to enter. And first Sheehan wouldn't respond to any questions, but then she suddenly sprang up, yelling, "Get out of here. You don't have a warrant. I have a knife and I'll kill you if I have to." The social worker couldn't see whether she had a knife or not, but what she did do, was call the police. She had determined that, an immediate intervention by law enforcement was necessary, for Sheehan to protect her and others. She had in fact checked off a box on the form, which indicated that she believed Sheehan was gravely disabled and a threat to others. Police officers responded. They went to the group home. They went up to Sheehan's door, knocked on the door, said that they wanted to help her. Sheehan didn't answer. The officers used the social worker's key to enter. At that time, Sheehan, armed with a kitchen knife with a 5-inch blade, began approaching the officers, saying, "She's going to kill you." Saying, "I'm going to kill you. I don't need help. Get out." At that time, the officers retreated and closed the door. Nonetheless, the police officers called for backup, but nonetheless, they were concerned that the door to Sheehan's room was closed. They had seen other weapons or similar type weapons, knives in the room, or one of the officers did anyway. There was a back window from which Sheehan might escape, so the officers decided they had to make a decision. They couldn't wait for backup. They entered the room. At that time, with a knife in hand, yelled for the police to leave. Whatever happened next, it was a fast-moving situation. They pepper sprayed Sheehan. She wouldn't drop the knife, and then the police officer shot her multiple times. She survived. So those are the facts. But the legal issue itself was interesting. That is whether, because Sheehan had a mental illness, that the ADA applied to this government action. That is whether police officers had to take special steps in order to subdue her and protect the public. The Ninth Circuit held that the ADA did apply, and they found that the police officers weren't necessarily immune from suit. It was a summary judgment motion, and the police officers claimed qualified immunity. San Francisco applied for cert, and this case is probably more interesting for the civil procedural issue. It applied for cert, and arguing before the Supreme Court, the city of San Francisco actually conceded that Title II, the ADA did apply when police officers make an arrest. Supreme Court was not happy with that. They determined that if that was the case and if that San Francisco was going to defend the case on a theory that wasn't the theory that was prevented for which that was presented when cert was granted, then there was no real adversarial testing of the legal proposition, and they decided to dismiss it as improvidently granted, although they did go on to determine the second question, which is whether the police officers were qualifiedly immune from suit because they were doing their duty and there was no clearly established federal law that what they did was wrong. Scalia writes a concurrence, which is well worth reading for any litigants out there, or potential people who like to get to the Supreme Court, think of ways to get to the Supreme Court, where he basically accused San Francisco of litigation gamesmanship. That is, they knew that the cert-worthy issue had a good chance of being taken before the Supreme Court and that the second issue would be resolved, which is the actual liability issue, which is what San Francisco, I'm sure, cared a lot about. And they won on the second issue, and Scalia thought that the court was basically giving San Francisco a gift and that they really weren't interested in arguing the or chose not to argue the issue for which cert was granted. So that's an issue. If it ever comes up again, the Supreme Court may take it, whether the ADA applies to police officers making an arrest. So with that, I turn it over to John.
Okay. The next case I'd like to discuss is Clark versus Ohio, which is a very important case involving sad facts involving the Confrontation Clause. The issue was whether the general ban on out-of-court statements as evidence at trial, that is if the person who made those statements doesn't show up for trial, applies when the statements were made to someone other than a police officer gathering evidence for prosecution. The defendant in that case, Darius Clark, was convicted of abusing his girlfriend's 3-year-old son and 18-month-old daughter. They were both in his care because he was his girlfriend's pimp and had sent the girlfriend out to prostitute herself. The defendant objected to the admission of an out-of-court statement that the 3-year-old boy made to his preschool teacher, who had noticed marks on the boy's body, that implicated Clark as his abuser. Under Ohio law, the teacher had a mandatory obligation to report the conversation to law enforcement officials, and under a separate Ohio law, the 3-year-old was deemed incompetent to testify at trial. Justice Alito delivered the opinion of the court, joined by Chief Justice Roberts and Kennedy, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan, holding that the introduction at trial of a statement made by a minor to his preschool teacher implicating the defendant did not violate the defendant's Sixth Amendment rights under the Confrontation Clause. He noted that pursuant to the court's opinion in 2004 opinion in Crawford versus Washington, the Confrontation Clause generally prohibits the introduction of testimonial statements by non-testifying witnesses, unless the witness is unavailable to testify and the defendant has had a prior opportunity to cross-examine that witness. However, a statement generally qualifies as testimonial only if the primary purpose of the conversation, based on an evaluation of all of the relevant circumstances, was to create an out-of-court substitute for trial testimony. The court stated that not every out-of-court statement that satisfies his primary purpose test would be barred by the Confrontation Clause, and that the clause would also not prohibit the introduction of statements that would have been admissible in a criminal case at the time of the founding. Here, the majority found that the boy's statement was not testimonial, in that it was not made with the primary purpose of creating evidence in a prosecution against the defendant. The court went further than that and said that statements by very young children will rarely, if ever, implicate the Confrontation Clause, and as well that statements by young children were regularly admitted at the common law. The court also added that statements made to individuals who are not principally charged with uncovering criminal behavior, like a teacher, are significantly less likely to be testimonial than statements made to law enforcement officers. And the fact that there was a mandatory reporting requirement to law enforcement officers did not change this. Justice Scalia, joined by Justice Ginsburg, wrote a very interesting concurring opinion. He concurred in the result, but chastised the majority rather severely for attempting to undermine Crawford. That's the 2004 case. Justice Scalia believes that the Crawford opinion restored the Confrontation Clause to its original meaning and provided for strong enforcement of the Confrontation Clause. It is very clear that Justice Scalia is worried that the court may return to the more mushy, prosecutor-friendly indicia of reliability standard that existed prior to Crawford under Ohio versus Roberts. Justice Thomas also wrote a separate concurring opinion, but argued that the proper test ought to be whether the statement at issue bore the indicia of being, quote, a solemn declaration or affirmation made for the purpose of establishing or proving some fact, and that that was not the case here. Dean, on to you.
Thank you, John. The next case will be a short summary of an relatively interesting decision that will have some effects when it comes to pro se federal litigants. The case is Coleman Bay v. Tollefson. Justice Breyer delivered the opinion once again of a unanimous court. Ordinarily, a federal litigant who's too poor to pay court fees may proceed in forma pauperis, meaning the litigant may commence a civil action without prepaying fees or paying certain expenses. But there's a special three strikes provision which prevents a court from affording in forma pauperis status where the litigant is a prisoner and he or she, quote, has, on three or more prior occasions while incarcerated, brought an action or appeal in a court of the United States that was dismissed on the grounds that it is frivolous, malicious, or fails to state a claim upon which relief may be granted. Before the Supreme Court case, a federal district court had dismissed Coleman Bay's three actions brought by Coleman Bay on those grounds. While the third dismissal was pending on appeal, the prisoner sought to bring several additional actions in the federal courts. That is, his third action was dismissed. He appealed it, and while that appeal was pending, he filed more actions. The question before the court was whether the prisoner may litigate his new actions in forma pauperis. The court decided that where an appeals court has not yet decided whether a prior dismissal is legally proper, courts should in fact count that dismissal when calculating how many qualifying dismissals the litigant has suffered. That is three strikes and you're out. And that's what Congress wanted, that's what it said, and that's what the rule is. The petitioner, you know, made a somewhat valiant argument as saying that, you know, the appeal isn't fully dismissed the action isn't fully dismissed until it's reviewed in a reviewing court, an appeals court. But the Supreme Court wasn't having any of it. They again cited the plain language, and this, you know, the plain language and plain text has been a big issue this term, and said, no, the action was dismissed. It was dismissed in the trial court. There's no qualifier to it. This rule is there to prevent vexatious litigants from abusing the courts, from abusing the court system. It could take who knows how long to resolve an appeal, 6 months, a year, maybe longer. And in that time, this litigant, who's already been determined by trial court several times to be abusive, can continue to abuse the court process and file frivolous actions. If there was any issue afterwards, that if it turns out the appeal was meritorious, which the court noted, the Solicitor General checked the stats, and it didn't often happen that the appeals court would reverse a trial court in deeming an action non-frivolous after the district court ruled that in fact was, that there's recourse for that pro se prisoner. That is, he can file a Rule 60B motion for reconsideration or a few other things that he or she could do. So it's an interesting case when it comes to, if anyone wants to, you know, for statutory interpretation, the law says what it says. It's not ambiguous. It's a short opinion. It's unanimous. And with that, I turn it over to John.
Okay. The next case I want to discuss is Patel versus City of Los Angeles. The opinion in that case was written by Justice Sotomayor, joined by the other justices in the liberal wing of the court and perennial swing vote Anthony Kennedy. In that case, the court held that a Los Angeles municipal ordinance that required hotel and motel operators to maintain certain specific information about their guests for 90 days and to permit the police to inspect that information at any time without a search warrant or even probable cause, that ordinance was facially unconstitutional. At the outset, the court noted that a party doesn't have to wait for the government to demand information in a particular case to bring a lawsuit. That would be an as-applied challenge. But rather, a party could challenge such a law as it applies across the board, even if the police could obtain that same information in other ways or for other reasons. The majority held that the ordinance violates the Fourth Amendment because it authorizes the police to search the motel operator's files without a warrant, and that the exception to the warrant requirement for heavily regulated businesses doesn't apply. The majority discussed at length the exception for heavily regulated businesses, and it appeared to restrict that exception to the four industries that had been previously granted that status. The exception for heavily regulated industries, by the way, would just require a showing of reasonableness on behalf of the law enforcement by law enforcement authorities to conduct the inspection, and it applies primarily to businesses that have been subject to comprehensive regulation that have been found to be intrinsically dangerous. The court discussed the four examples of qualifying industries. They are firearms dealing, liquor sales, mining, and automobile junkyards. And the court held that motels, even though they can be used for nefarious ends, would not qualify. The court held that absent an exigent circumstance, consent, or some other well-recognized exception to the warrant requirement, a hotel owner must be given, quote, an opportunity to have a neutral decision maker review an officer's demand to search the registry before he or she faces penalties for failing to comply. That was not the case here, by the way. The ordinance stated that if somebody refused, a hotel owner refused to turn over the registry to a law enforcement officer, he could be arrested on site and subject to potential misdemeanor penalties. The court stated that, quote, actual review need only occur in those rare instances where a hotel operator objects to turning over the registry. And the majority noted that such a requirement should not prove to be terribly onerous or time-consuming, and that if necessary, the police can secure the registry pending a hearing if they fear that it might be destroyed or altered during the interim. Justice Scalia, joined by Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Thomas, dissented, concluding that the ordinance was constitutional under the heavily regulated business exception to the warrant requirement, and that a warrant requirement here was unnecessary, overly burdensome, and would result in more crime, specifically talking about drugs and human trafficking. Just in general, assignations and drug dealing takes place behind the privacy of hotel rooms, and that having this requirement of allowing the registry to be searched on site by police officers would serve as a deterrent to crime. Justice Alito filed a separate dissent, joined by Justice Thomas, concluding that the ordinance was not facially unconstitutional because there are a number of instances in which the ordinance could be constitutionally applied. Justice Alito is not a fan of facial challenges to any statute at all, including this one. And with that, let me turn it back to Dean.
Thank you very much, John. I'm getting more comfortable with this. next case is Davis v. Ayala, which is an interesting federal habeas case where the defendant was sentenced to the death penalty after a triple murder approximately 25 years ago, and the Ninth Circuit allowed the federal habeas petition and granted relief. The Ninth Circuit, as often happens, was reversed by the Supreme Court on a 5-4 decision. Justice Alito wrote the opinion of the court. The issue really was what's called, people may or may not know, as a prosecutor, I'm well familiar with Batson v. Kentucky, which is which talks about when the prosecution uses peremptory challenges of prospective jurors, peremptory challenges meaning challenges that the prosecution and defense have where they can strike prospective jurors for no reason. Of course, you can strike it for no reason, but at the same time, you cannot strike for a prohibited reason. And determining whether or not a prosecutor is striking for a prohibited reason is something that has vexed courts, judges, practitioners for a long time, ever since Batson was decided in 1986. And in Massachusetts, we have our analog to Batson that was actually decided years before Batson. When adjudicating a Batson claim, trial courts follow a three-step process. That is, a defendant must make a prima facie showing that a peremptory challenge has been exercised on the basis of race. You do that by just the pattern of the pattern of prospective jurors who have been struck and their and the racial composition of those jurors. If the showing has been made, the prosecution has to offer a race-neutral basis for striking the juror in question. That is, no judge, I didn't strike juror six because he's Hispanic or she's Hispanic. I struck her because on her juror questionnaire, she stated that she has problems with the death penalty. So that's a race-neutral reason. And then in light of the party submissions, the trial court must determine whether the defendant has shown purposeful discrimination. That is, the judge either is going to accept the prosecutor's reason for why he or she struck the juror or won't. That is, and believes it's a pretext and that they were actually striking for the prohibited purpose of striking based on someone's group identity. In any event, what happened here was, and this is this trial happened a long time ago, as I said, 25 years ago. It's California. I've never practiced in the state courts of California, but apparently it's very involved and very complicated because it took a long time to pick a jury in this case, I think several months. It was a triple homicide, so I'm sure they weren't going to not expend resources on it. Nonetheless, what happened was after the prosecutor used seven peremptory challenges to challenge all the African and Hispanic prospective jurors. So right there you have a what some would consider a prima facie showing. And what happened was the trial judge allowed the prosecutor's motion to explain his reasons for striking those jurors, presumably race-neutral reasons, ex parte, that is, without the defendant's attorney there to test and probe and question, ask questions of the judge when the prosecutor was giving his reasons as to why he was doing this. Another problem with this case that the Ninth Circuit had was because the case was so old, all the questionnaires by the people who didn't sit, that is the prospective jurors who were challenged and weren't in the final jury, all those questionnaires were destroyed. So when you go over Batson, speak from experience, you look over everything, you compare jurors who were sat to ones who weren't sat, to ones who were challenged, to ones who weren't challenged, and it gets really complicated. The Ninth Circuit, again, they granted relief. One of the issues was, and it's a little esoteric, was the actual standard on federal habeas that federal court should use to show whether there was actually any prejudice, because the state court of California said even if the defense attorney was there to challenge what the prosecutor said were his reasons, non-racial reasons for striking these jurors, it wouldn't have made a difference because it was clear that the judge, accepted what the prosecutor said. There probably wasn't going to be much of anything that the defense attorney, based on the whole record, that the defense attorney could have said to dispute that. There was a strong dissent by the four, I would say, liberal justices of the Supreme Court, written by Sotomayor, where she discusses the standard. No one disputes the standard. It's whether or not the error had a substantial and injurious effect on the verdict, which is Brecht v. Abramson. Sotomayor said you can't say that's not the case, and just discuss what things the defense attorney could have said in those circumstances, and that there was a reasonable chance that the error, that is, by having this ex parte hearing, which everyone agreed was wrong, whether or not it contributed to the verdict or whether or not it made a difference. Kind of along the lines of the case John was just referring to, there is a concurrence by Justice Kennedy in Davis v. Ayala, where he makes clear that he joins the court, he joins unqualifiedly in the majority's opinion. But he does go on for several pages about, and some people may have read about this, or about 5 or 6 pages, about the fact that the defendant has spent the past 25 years in solitary confinement. And Justice Kennedy goes on, it really stands out from the rest of the opinion. He discusses literature, social science, and talks about how a long-term in solitary confinement, what kind of punishment that is and how horrible it is and why, you know, people really aren't thinking about this and that we should think about it. And I'll quote him, in a case that presented the issue, the judiciary may be required within its proper jurisdiction and authority to determine whether workable alternative systems for long-term confinement exist, and if so, whether a correctional system should be required to adopt them. Then he quotes Dostoevsky, the degree of civilization in a society can be judged by entering its prisons. And then he says, there is truth to this in our own time. And this is just fun. So then Justice Thomas concurs, and he writes separately. Again, he agrees, just like Justice Kennedy did, with the entirety of the majority opinion. But he writes separately to point out that, quote, the accommodations in which Ayala, the defendant, is housed are a far sight more spacious than those in which his victims, Ernesto Dominguez Mendez, Marcos Antonio Zamora, and Jose Luis Rositas, now rest. And given that his victims were all 31 years of age or under, Ayala will soon have had as much or more time to enjoy those accommodations as his victims had time to enjoy this earth. Close quote. So some interesting fireworks there, and we'll see where that leads. But Davis v. Ayala, Ninth Circuit, again reversed on a federal habeas in a capital case. And with that, I turn it over to John.
Thank you, Dean. The next case that I'd like to discuss is similar to a case decided earlier this term, the Alanis case. It's McFadden versus United States, and that both cases provide guidance about what and how the government has to prove in terms of mens rea in a criminal prosecution. While the Alanis case involved threatening communications, McFadden involved narcotics, specifically analog drugs. Those are drugs that are substantially similar to controlled substances in their chemical structure as well as their effect on humans. McFadden was arrested for distributing bath salts, which are not a Schedule I drug, but which are considered to be analogs to a variety of prohibited substances. Under the Controlled Substance Analog Enforcement Act of 1986, drugs that are analogous to those appearing on the federal controlled substance schedules are themselves to be treated as controlled substances. McFadden contended that he didn't know that the bath salts he was distributing were considered to be analogs of controlled substances, and that he therefore didn't knowingly distribute a controlled substance. The trial court instructed the jury that they could convict McFadden if he knowingly and intentionally distributed a substance designed for consumption, and that the substance happened to be an analog of a controlled substance and hence should be treated as a controlled substance itself. In a nearly unanimous opinion by Justice Thomas, the court reversed the conviction and held that the jury instruction inaccurately conveyed the requisite mens rea, and that to obtain a conviction, the government would have to prove that the defendant knew either that he was distributing a substance that was prohibited under the Analog Act, or that he knew the identity or character of the substance he was dealing with. The court did state, though, that the defendant would not have to be aware of the substance's legal status under the Analog Act, but that he would have to know that it was an analog to a controlled substance, meaning he would have to know that it had a similar chemical structure or that it had a similar effect on human beings as a controlled substance. The court remanded the case for a harmless error review because the government contended that no rational jury could have believed that McFadden was unaware that the substances he was distributing were controlled or were not controlled. Chief Justice Roberts concurred in the judgment, but expressed the view that, in his opinion, in an appropriate case, he believed that a defendant should be able to assert a defense based on the claim that he didn't know that the substance he was distributing was, in fact, a controlled substance. Robert said that when, quote, when well-known drugs such as heroin are involved, knowledge of identity may be self-evident to prove that knowledge, that the substance was controlled, but that for lesser-known drugs, the same would not necessarily be true. He offered the following, what he called, quote, a pop quiz for any reader who doubts the point. Two drugs, I'm going to mispronounce these, dextromethorphan or hydrocodone, are both used as cough suppressants. They are also both used as recreational drugs. Which one is a controlled substance? The answer, which he provided in a footnote, by the way, is hydrocodone. Dean, let me turn it back to you.
Sure. Thank you, John. And I'll do the final two cases. One is interesting, which is Henderson versus the United States, decided in May, again by unanimous court, where this Supreme Court considered whether, I'll say Justice Kagan wrote the opinion, and she wrote this: government agencies sometimes come into possession of firearms lawfully owned by individuals facing serious criminal charges. If convicted, such a person cannot recover his guns because a federal statute prohibits any felon from possessing firearms. In this case, we consider what a court can do when a felon instead seeks the transfer of his guns to either a firearms dealer or some other third party. We hold that Section 922G does not bar such a transfer unless it would allow the felon to later control the guns so that he could either use them or direct their use. Basically, Tony Henderson, the petitioner, was charged with distributing marijuana. He surrendered all his firearms as a condition of bail. The FBI took custody of the guns. Henderson pleaded guilty to the distribution charge. As a result of that conviction, Section 922G prevents him from legally repossessing his firearms. He's a felon. He cannot own firearms. Following his release from prison, Henderson asked the FBI to transfer the guns to a friend of his who had agreed to purchase them for an unspecified price. The FBI denied the request, and in a letter to Henderson, it said that, quote, the release of the firearms to the friend would place you in violation of 922G, as it would amount to constructive possession of the guns. Henderson then returned to the criminal court and asked it to exercise its equitable powers and not turn over the guns to him, but allow him to transfer the guns to the person of his choosing. The district court denied the motion and said that Henderson could not transfer the firearms or receive money for their sale without constructively possessing them in violation of 922G. The 11th Circuit affirmed, reasoning that granting Henderson's motion would amount to giving a felon constructive possession of his firearms. So this is an interesting case. The defendant, now a federally convicted felon, obviously cannot possess the firearm, has no right to do it. For the FBI to give it to turn it over to him would be unlawful. At the same time, at the end of any criminal case, what happens is, you know, evidence that's taken from a defendant that has no reason to be in the government's possession any longer should be turned over to him. But what do? You can't, you know, the government can't turn over this firearm. So can he direct its transfer to a third party? The Supreme Court said absolutely. They really shot down, and again, in the unanimous opinion, the government's argument that somehow by directing the transfer to a third party, he's actually maintaining possession. There's two kinds of possession, constructive and actual. Actual means actual physical possession. You hold something in your hand. Constructive possession means, you know, you may not hold it in your hand, but, you know, this is my pen. I place it, you know, on the chair across from me. I can pick it up whenever I want. I'm not holding it in my hand, but I still possess it. The government said by transferring it to that third party at his direction, the defendant, who has no right to actually physically possess the gun, is still controlling it in some way. The Supreme Court didn't like that argument at all. They said unless the government can show, or unless there's a reason for the court to believe that when the defendant directs the transfer of that firearm to a third party, that he actually has some hidden power to control it. That is, if I say, you know, I can't own a rifle anymore. Can you give it to my brother who lives with me? And actually, I use it and take it out hunting whenever I want, even though it's, you know, technically it's in the possession of my brother. Unless there's some reason to think that, the defendant can transfer or direct that the property, his former property, be transferred to anyone he wants. The court can get assurances from the person, the transferee, that the gun is not under the control of the former defendant, and that in fact, if it was some kind of a sham transaction, that the transferee could be charged with aiding and abetting the illegal possession of a firearm by a federal felon. So it's another short opinion, kind of like that earlier one. Coleman Bay, unanimous and interesting legal issue, and that's that. I'm not sure how much of a problem that was. It really seems like kind of an anomalous turn of the law, but the Supreme Court straightened that out. So that is Henderson versus the United States. The last case is a case that came out on the same day that the same-sex marriage decision came out, so it kind of snuck in under the radar for some people. It's Johnson versus the United States, where the Supreme Court, I believe it was a 5-4, no, it was a almost
six.
Unanimous, yep, no, was
six
it 6-3?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, well, Alito wrote the dissent. The Armed Career Criminal Act, it's what's called its residual clause, meaning its catch-all clause, was held by the court to be unconstitutionally vague. The log line of the case is the Armed Career Criminal Act of 1984. Under that act, a defendant convicted of being a felon in possession of a firearm faces more severe punishment if he has three or more previous convictions for a, quote, a violent felony, close quote, a term defined to include any felony that involves conduct that presents a serious potential risk of physical injury to another. The court had to decide whether that part of the definition, that is, that residual clause defining violent felony, survived the Constitution's prohibition of vague criminal laws. For criminal law mavens or armed career criminal hack mavens who may be listening in, this residual clause has been a problem for several years. The cases get very, very complicated. The last case they dealt with, the Supreme Court dealt with Scalia, was very explicit, saying he believed that that term was unconstitutionally vague. That is, it's hard to say under the court's jurisprudence, you know, what how to define or how anyone could know what conduct presents a serious potential risk of physical injury to another when you're not actually applying it. And this is kind of a unique to the court's own jurisprudence in this area, that it's you're not applying it to the actual case, but the general crime, the ordinary crime, and a court has to make a determination as to whether the conduct, the crime, would present a serious potential risk of physical injury to another, and they kind of have to do it in a vacuum. So the issue became that the circuit courts were all over the place on how to apply that residual clause. Different courts use different tests, and in the end, you know, the Supreme Court, and taken to task by Justice Alito, kind of just, you know, threw up its hands and said this is just too complicated. It leaves too much ground to be filled. It's not definite. No one knows what kind of crimes it covers. He even gives it a little list. He says since 2007. This court's decided four cases where we've attempted to discern its meaning. We've held that the residual clause covers Florida's offense of attempted burglary, does not cover New Mexico's offense of driving under the influence, does not cover Illinois' offense of failure to report to a penal institution, and four, does cover Indiana's offense of vehicular flight from a law enforcement officer. And that was Sykes in 2011, where Scalia said we should just get rid of this vague residual clause. It's a significant sentencing enhancement that's often used in federal courts, but in the end, the Supreme Court said it's the penalty is just too high and the standard is just too amorphous. So we're basically going to strike down that portion of the Armed Career Criminal Act as unconstitutional. There's a concurrence by Justice Thomas, where he pretty much, although he concurs in the judgment, really just thinks there was a better way to rule in this case, and that you didn't have to decide that that part of the statute was unconstitutionally vague at all. And he goes into a little soliloquy, which is worth reading for fans of the Supreme Court, about the unconstitutional vagueness doctrine. Really sounds too much like substantive due process, and again, that's become an issue in this term for other reasons and in other cases, but that it just gives too much power to judges to strike down laws that they disagree with or just find too complicated or too hard to figure out or do the work to figure it out. The cases, I've tried to read them, you know, the four cases that Justice Scalia mentioned and I just mentioned, you really get into the weeds on statutory interpretation, and, you know, no one's going to deny that the case law is quite confusing. But Judge Alito gives a passionate and blistering dissent where he basically takes the court to task for, you know, basically blaming the court itself for making the case law so Byzantine in this area that it's really not that hard to do. It's not unconstitutionally vague. Tons of states have kind of similar standards when making a determination about what penalty is appropriate for particular conduct, and that the language is almost word for word, you know, conduct that presents a serious potential risk of physical injury to another in plenty of statutes throughout the country. But of course, Scalia then, you know, retorts that, well, you know, that doesn't fit in with how we've determined we should analyze these cases, and Alito goes back and says, well, all right, that's the problem we made for ourselves by first starting this framework and realizing that the residual clause doesn't fit. And the line of cases is about sentencing enhancements for prior convictions from other states and how you determine what exactly the significance is of, you know, a conviction for a particular crime in a particular state at a particular time and how that would apply to a sentencing enhancement in federal court. So that's, you know, kind of the long version of Johnson v. United States, which is going to be a big deal in federal courts because people are often charged under the residual clause. My understanding is that there's been plenty of cases on hold for just this case, Johnson v. United States. And as John said, defendants have made out pretty well this term, and Johnson v. United States coming at the tail end is one of the big reasons why they've done pretty well. So.
And actually, before we turn it back to Dean, just to clarify, so Scalia wrote the majority opinion, joined by five other justices, saying, unconstitutional.
Got it.
Facially unconstitutional. Kennedy and Thomas both concurred in the judgment, saying not void for vagueness, but that the residual clause should not have applied to Johnson.
Correct.
And Alito wrote a dissenting opinion saying not void for vagueness and that the residual clause should have applied to Johnson.
Yes. Perfect. Confusing, just like the law in the area has been. So, thank you. Yes.
Thank you.
With that, I'll turn it over to Dean Reuter, I think. Yeah.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. This is Dean Reuter. We've, as promised, covered a great deal of territory. We do have some time for questions, so let's go right to the audience. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your phone. So I think our experts today are willing to take questions on any of the cases they've discussed. Just a reminder before we get started, or an announcement before we get started, tomorrow we'll be hosting a teleforum conference call with Charles Murray talking about his new book. That will be at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. On Wednesday, we'll be speaking with author Judith Miller and best-selling author Arthur Herman about the new book by Judith Miller. So that's tomorrow at 1 and then Wednesday at noon. Today, of course, we're talking about the criminal law cases in the Supreme Court's term this year. If you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your phone. Let's take our first call.
Yes, this is Bill Otis. I'm very happy to be able to ask a question of our two very distinguished guests. Indeed, I'm so happy that I'm making this call from the beach in Hawaii. So devoted am I, John, to your
I'm very impressed, Bill. I'm jealous, too.
I haven't met Dean yet, but I'll be looking forward to it. My question concerns one case that you mentioned, although you didn't describe it in today's call, and that's the Glossop case.
Right.
That I think was the big headliner in criminal law, especially for those of us who follow death penalty. And I want to ask a couple of questions about that. Although I think I have to agree that defendants made off pretty well in the term overall, I think Glossop, for three reasons, was a big dent in the side of the abolitionist movement. Two of them concern what what did not happen, and one of them concerns what was going on in the opinion. The most important thing that did not happen is that Justice Kennedy, who has been sometimes for the defendant, sometimes for the government, both this term and in previous terms, did not write separately and joined word for word in Justice Alito's strong opinion that, among other things, built on Bays and now makes it the opinion of a majority of the court that, quote, the death penalty is constitutional. And when Kennedy did not write any kind of concurrence and did not qualify anything that went on in Justice Alito's opinion for the court, I think that has tremendous significance, and not a significance that abolitionists of the death penalty will welcome. The second thing that did not happen is that Justices Sotomayor and Kagan did not sign on to any part of Justice Breyer's comprehensive dissent, taking the view that the death penalty is very likely unconstitutional in all its applications. Justice Breyer's opinion was a tour de force, if one wants to look at it in that way, in modern abolitionist thinking, and set forth three or four of the most important abolitionist arguments that you hear now. When Kagan and Sotomayor didn't sign on to any part of the opinion that Breyer wrote, I thought that was very much the dog that did not bark concerning the question how many justices actually are prepared to rule that the death penalty is unconstitutional per se. If Justices Kagan and Sotomayor thought that, this was their perfect opportunity. There will never be a better opportunity than to sign on to Justice Breyer's dissent. So I thought not doing that, again, was the dog that didn't bark. The third thing, the thing that did happen, is that the court has now taken notice in its opinion and, of course, in the questioning and oral argument of the abolitionist shake and jive that is trying to get the death penalty to be found unconstitutional because of the gross amount of delay and expense that abolitionists themselves cause. Justice Alito referred to this in oral argument, and I believe in the opinion, as guerrilla war against the death penalty, in which abolitionists do not take it on as unjust or even unconstitutional as the Constitution is written, but simply make a policy argument that, on account of their own behavior, it's become just too much to try to enforce as a practical matter. I think the court's taking note of that is a big step forward for people who support the death penalty, and I'd like to know Dean's reaction and John's reaction as to whether I'm missing something here or whether they think I'm barking up the right tree.
Well, this is John. Let me I actually did mention Glossop at the very beginning of my remarks. I agree and I disagree in this sense. You are, of course, correct in everything that you said. However, Justice Sotomayor's opinion, which was joined by Justice Kagan, did not go quite so far as the Breyer dissent joined by Justice Ginsburg, but she did very much imply, likened the current three-judge cocktail regime that was now approved in Glossop to essentially a defendant being drawn and quartered, and pretty much implied that if the court were to do anything so horrible as to go back to one of the previous methods of execution, a gas chamber, a firing squad, etc., that might very well be unconstitutional under the very fuzzy Trope v. Dulles standard of, the Eighth Amendment being applied based on evolving standards of decency that mark the signs of progress of a maturing society or whatever that, very, very fuzzy standard is. Of course, Justice Scalia, in his concurring opinion, said that if there was another death penalty case, that he would want to have the issue presented about whether Trope v. Dulles standard makes any sense whatsoever. So, you are right that the death penalty has lived on for another day, and you can take some solace in the fact that Sotomayor and Kagan did not join onto the Breyer dissent. But I do find it significant that two sitting justices for the first time has said that they believe the death penalty may be unconstitutional in all of its applications, and two other justices I think are not that far away, although they did not join on to that opinion. So I would take some solace, but I wouldn't be taking that much solace.
Yeah, all I have to say, Dean Mazzoni, is yeah, I would keep a close eye on this. I think it was interesting that, I mean, maybe it happens, and it's happened in prior terms, but you know, the Brumfield v. Cain with Justice Thomas and his writing in that case, along with going back to Davis v. Ayala, where Kennedy goes on with Thomas about, you know, what about, you know, we should care about this person, this poor defendant, you know, he's been in solitary confinement for all these years, and Justice Thomas says, you know, let's not forget about the victims, and let's not forget about the victims. I think Justice Thomas does a great service in that. I think things are getting kind of emotional, and that they're dialing it up a notch when it comes to capital cases, and you know, we'll just have to see. I'm not so sanguine. I think Justice Kennedy's concurrence in Davis is something to think about. It's not a you know, and he didn't say anything about capital punishment per se, but he certainly has issues with the way punishment is meted out in this country and how it always has been, and he thinks seems to think some things should change and that the judiciary should change it. And I hate to read too much into the tea leaves a lot. I'm not that good at it, and I've been disappointed before. So that's.
Yeah, I guess I would add one other thing, which is to say that if your standard of constitutional standard is evolving standards of decency,
yeah,
it's truly your quintessential living constitution standard, and tomorrow is another day.
Yep.
And of course, not in this case, but in other death penalty cases, Justice Kennedy has cited international law, and if he has that kind of thing in the back of his mind as he goes off to teach for the summer in Austria, then you know, you never know what the next term will bring.
Well, only good things come out of Austria, right?
Maybe actually, if I could just add one more word here about the future of the death penalty methods, and I agree, under this evolving standards of decency, the mischief can always be in the offing, and one cannot know from term to term how Justice Kennedy is going to come out. But as a practical matter, the coming method of execution is nitrogen gas, which has two very useful features for people who support the death penalty. One is that, unlike lethal injections, it does not produce internal burning. You continue breathing. It's just that the nitrogen displaces oxygen, and you go to sleep. There's no pain involved in it. And the second thing is that nitrogen can be produced internally in the United States. It does not depend on European suppliers. I think there's already been that Oklahoma is one state that's already adopted nitrogen gas. And so I think in this one area anyway, those who would retain the death penalty are one step ahead of those who would abolish it.
Yeah, I think I think that they adopted nitrogen gas if their three-cocktail regime was rejected in this case. So it wasn't rejected in this case, so I don't think they're going to go to nitrogen gas, but we'll see.
Let me ask, this is Dean Reuter here, let me ask a quick question. John Malcolm mentioned in his remarks that it was a term that sort of favored the defendants. I want to find out if Dean Mazzoni agrees with that, if I got you right, John. And then secondly, is that trend extended beyond or before this term? Are the defendants winning more than they're losing in the sort of maybe the Roberts Court or the last 20 years? What's your sense of that, or the last 5 years?
Well, certainly when it comes to Scalia, he revolutionized, you know, the Sixth Amendment and the Confrontation Clause, you know, from Melendez-Diaz to as a Crawford case, which is, you know, certificates of analysis for drug samples. and through a whole, you know, autopsy reports for a whole host of issues that in the end redound only, you know, to a defendant's benefit. Of course, he'll say, and he does say, that, you know, Crawford is a strike for originalism, and in a way it is. But it also, again, redounds to the benefit of the defendants. And just as in the Confrontation Clause case that John was talking about, Ohio v. Clark, where it's clear that Scalia does not like or is somewhat hostile to any stepping back from what he would consider his important work. And sometimes originalism does redound to the benefit of defendants. So you do see a lot of that, certainly in that area. And death penalty, there've been close cases. You tend to see, you know, AEDPA was a huge, huge deal when it was passed by that Congress in 94 or whatever year it was, that really constrained federal review of state court convictions. But there's been a lot of pushback on that. There's some pushback, not in the case I discussed, but there's been some pushback in the standards to apply for evidentiary hearings throughout the federal system. So I think generally you're seeing that kind of swing back, you know, in favor of defendants, but we'll have to see. So that's just my sense, and certainly Johnson v. United States is an important case. So.
I mean, if I could, Dean, elaborate on my answer, which is, look, not that many criminal cases reach the court's docket,
right.
And by definition, defendants have lost at every level until they reach the Supreme Court. So if they win any of these cases, it can be a pretty big deal for the defense bar. That having been said, I do think that in a couple of areas, one of them the Fourth Amendment, so you had, you know, the intoxication field sobriety test term, you know, last term of the term before that. And here
and
you
Riley,
have Rodriguez case.
And Riley
yeah,
v. California. That's – I'm sorry. I should have mentioned that, right? That's a huge case.
That's
that,
right.
That helps defendants. So sorry.
I think on the Fourth Amendment, the court is providing some relief to criminal defendants. And I also think so. If you look at a case like the Yates case, which involved a very broad statute that could potentially apply to a huge amount of conduct and could be abused, much like the prosecution of Carol Ann Bond a couple of terms ago, that the court is very, very skeptical of vague statutes can be applied that broadly. And in terms of the Alanis case and the McFadden case, I think the court's also setting a signal that before you're going to convict somebody of a very, very serious crime, the focus needs to be on the defendant's knowledge. There needs to be something of a tough mens rea standard. You can't just look at this conduct and say, well, this is bad conduct, that there needs to be some proof of acknowledgement of wrongdoing on the part of the defendant. So I think in those areas, the court is helping out the criminal defense bar.
Well, gentlemen, we've used up the budgeted time, and indeed we've gone over the budgeted time. But again, thank you both for joining us. Thanks to John Malcolm and Dean Mazzoni. This has been a far-reaching discussion, and we certainly appreciate you digesting each one of these cases and presenting them to our audience. And to the audience, a reminder that our next scheduled Teleform conference call is tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern time, when we'll be visiting with author Charles Murray. Until that next call, though, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.